This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 9th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. On today's show, we're asking, how do you write about politics? There's so much said and written about the people and the parties that we've elected to rule us, but who are the people that police or poke fun at the politicians, and how do you get into that game? Are these people speaking truth to power, or are they features writers with a speciality? Do you need to know everything, or are you better off as a voice of the people? Should your criticism only be constructive, or is there a case for taking the mickey? On today's show, we'll talk to Michael Deacon, political sketch writer for the Daily Telegraph, on policing the lively, sometimes silly House of Commons.
There was a Guardian sketch writer in the 60s and 70s called Norman Shrapnel, and he, as an absolute matter of policy, would never, ever speak to an MP in any circumstances. He said, oh, I could never do that. It might dilute the purity of my hatred.
We'll speak to our Washington correspondent on why that satirical tradition just doesn't exist in the serious old world of US politics, and we'll visit Lebanon to see how on earth you make sense of the labyrinthine politics of that small, ever-interesting country. So, how you write about politics is this week's edition of Culture, with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We'll kick matters off here in the UK, home to some very good political writing. After all, Britain is one of the oldest democracies, one of the most celebrated or denigrated, depending upon your viewpoint, and one of the most keenly watched by the waggish and the waspish, ever eager to keep our government and its opposition on their toes. The Daily Telegraph is the newspaper that, more than any other in the UK perhaps, is a bastion of old-fashioned values, conservatism, and some very good writing too. I spoke to the paper's parliamentary and political sketch writer Michael Deacon about just what it is that his job entails and what he thinks his job is. I started off by asking him how on earth he got into it.
Well, in my case, it was entirely by accident. I didn't think I was going to be a political writer at all. I was working as a commissioning editor on the Telegraph's TV pages. And about 4 years ago, almost exactly 4 years ago, I happened to fall ill. I was off work for a week and I wasn't checking my emails during that time. When I got back to work a week later, I saw that pretty much the first email I'd missed was from the Telegraph's deputy editor. And the email simply said, Michael, can you come and see me, please? And I thought, oh, my goodness me, who have I libeled?
This is a disaster. Time you take a week off sick.
Exactly.
Right?
So I thought, I'm about to be sacked here for something. I don't know what. I went over and he said, yeah, Michael, we need a new political sketch writer all of a sudden. Would you like to do that? And if so, could you start immediately? Which is a bit alarming,
that's
given
right,
that I had never worked as a political correspondent in my life, or even a news reporter. I'd always worked in, you know, entertainment journalism. I think the reason they appointed me, though, is that I also happen to be writing a weekly notebook column in The Telegraph, which is basically a humour column. You know, my style was quite caricaturing and, you know, sort of parody, that kind of thing. So they thought that's the kind of writing style, I guess, you need to be a sketch writer. So they thought I'd be well suited to it. But it takes about 10 days before you can get a parliamentary pass. You have to have a special pass to get through security. And I used that 10 days basically to cram. It was like cramming for an exam. I basically ordered as many books as I could find of parliamentary sketches by all the greats, Quentin Letts, Simon Hoggart, Frank Johnson, Matthew Paris, all these people, just to see what a parliamentary sketch could do, what it was. What was it? Yes. What exactly is this thing that I suddenly find is my job? And I find basically it's just a kind of, it's a verbal cartoon. That's what it is. You're summing up the day's main political event, typically in about 500 words, but trying to do it in a satirical, amusing, entertaining, rather than dryly analytical way.
Were your fellow political sketch writers in the gallery in the Houses of Parliament here in the UK, were they sort of surprised, or did they have a sort of, was there a wry note of familiarity that you moved straight from the entertainment pages to the political pages in the Daily Telegraph, or indeed any newspaper, that there perhaps is only a cigarette paper's width between the small screen entertainment TV and sometimes what happens in Parliament?
Well, yeah, you know, sketching what happens in Parliament is actually very like reviewing the TV, which is what I've been doing. In fact, Quentin Letts, who is the sketch writer on the Daily Mail, is also the Mail's theatre critic. And he says they're very similar, except he says in the Commons the acting's just worse and the scripts are worse. But basically, it's exactly the same kind of activity. The other sketch writers had no problem with me. But the main difference between me and them at that time was that all four of the other sketch writers at that time had all, I think, started university before I was born. In some cases, completed university and been journalists for 10 years before I'd been born. So I did feel like the new boy at school there.
Well, that's
much.
Quite a good feeling, isn't it? That's often quite a good feeling. But, I mean, how clubbable is that collection of journalists then? Because you're not necessarily in competition. You're all writing copy, but it's basically it's a work of imagination and a work of wit and a work of satire and a work of kind of knowing your onions a bit as well. But you're not necessarily, you're not having to scurry to the front of the press conference to get quotes. It's not that sort of journalism, is it?
No. Well, sadly, I think it's less clubbable than it used to be. I think I've been born too late and I've missed all the fun years because, no, typically we go and sit in the press gallery, watch whatever it is we're going to watch, usually it's the same thing, and then we go back to our computers and just write. But apparently the way it used to be, certainly in the 80s, people like Matthew Paris, Craig Brown used to do it then, Simon Hoggart, was they would go into the press gallery, they would watch whatever they're going to watch, and then they would go to parliamentary cafes together and just sit there swapping jokes. And and they had a sort of unwritten rule where if someone has coined a joke, that's theirs. You can't then pinch it and put it in your copy. But that actually sounds broadly quite helpful, I would think.
The political parliamentary sketchwriter, is it a job? Your job is to be funny, your job is to be wry and amusing. Are you kind of speaking truth to power as well? I mean, because you're tripping a line between actual news journalism and the op-ed pages, presumably. You're somewhere in the middle, aren't you? You're kind of a starter.
Yes.
Sometimes people don't want a main course. So so are you kind of holding, people to account on those pages as well?
Well, I've been doing this job for 4 years now, and so far, as far as I'm aware, I haven't yet brought down a government. So I don't know if my influence is quite that strong. But yeah, as well as writing a joke, I'm trying to make some kind of point about what I think the Prime Minister or the leader of the opposition or whoever is really up to. I'm trying to translate what they are saying. If I think they're being dishonest about something or at least not telling the full truth about something, I will try to point that out. But, I'm not an investigative journalist. I'm not going to break a new scandal. That's very unlikely.
And I think our listeners all over the world will be familiar with Prime Minister's questions, PMQs, which happens at midday on Wednesdays. And they're famous for being kind of ribald, kind of crazy, pugilistic displays from the sort of opposition benches to the Prime Minister and back again. Jeremy Corbyn, the new leader of the Labour Party, has tried to make it a different sort of friendly politics that works rather than broken politics and make these less like boxing matches and more like a sort of town hall discussion, perhaps. What's that like as a parliamentary sketchwriter? Is it a bit more boring, or is there inherent humour in someone trying to kind of buck the system, buck the trend?
I've been disappointed with Jeremy Corbyn generally because I assumed all along throughout that Labour leadership campaign that he was going to make politics much more fun and indeed more funny for me, frankly. But it hasn't worked out like that. I think the great comic characters, I'm talking about in fiction here and also in sitcoms, they always have a pathos about them. They aren't just ridiculous. That's why I think Ed Miliband was the great character, unexpectedly a great character for a sketchwriter to write about, because not only would he say things that were silly or ill-advised or awkward, but also he had a pathos about him because you could see that fundamentally he was a decent man trying his very best to overcome his manifest failings, but never quite getting there. And he wanted to win so badly. Now, Jeremy Corbyn, you don't get that sense. He doesn't have a sense of pathos because you think, from his point of view, if he were to lose an election, it wouldn't necessarily matter to him as long as he felt that he'd stuck by his principles.
So you're not seeing two colossuses dueling it out in the Commons at the moment. You're seeing a Prime Minister with quite a lot of power and a Labour leader who kind of doesn't really mind if he's on the ropes or not. And that, I suppose, makes it less interesting for these traditional pugilistic displays. How often do you get to write about characters that pop up that ask questions in Parliament that people haven't heard of, but you think might be a star of the future? At least they make good copy for the likes of Michael Deakin.
Well, that happens a lot less often. I do tend to focus on the obvious names.
And the heavy hitters.
Yeah, I was very disappointed that Nigel Farage didn't win his seat. Not that I'm a supporter of UKIP, but simply because he's wonderful copy. I mean, he's still around. So thank goodness he unresigned so quickly after resigning. That was a great relief to me. I'd have been devastated without him. I'd have been bereft. I might have had to retire. So it's wonderful that he's back. There are a few good bonkers backbenchers around there. Philip Davis is an excellent example at the moment. I think people are finally starting to notice him. He's actually been around a good 10 years, Tory backbencher with, shall we say, quite strong right-wing views. He managed to, essentially by filibustering, by talking for a very long time, an unnecessarily long time, he managed to defeat a bill that would have seen no more parking charges for carers in hospital car parks, for example. And that's not been totally popular on social media, I would say. But that's quite typical, I would say, of his views.
What's a sort of typical day for you when you're at Parliament? You have an office there. When do you have to file your copy, and how often do you have to file a copy a week?
There's a little corridor that's just two flights of stairs up from where the Chamber of the House of Commons is, a little press corridor with these pokey little rooms, which is where all the journalists are crammed into. And I sit there sort of hammering away my whimsy, basically. But yeah, it totally varies. But, you know, I'm not even in the Commons every day. You know, sometimes there'll be a speech around the country, or it's party conference season, or if there's any kind of election coming up, I'll be going around the country. And those are actually, I think, sometimes the best days, because politicians talk very differently to each other in the House of Commons than they do when they're actually confronted by real human beings out in the terrifying real world. And it's always so much more interesting, so much more revealing about their character when you see David Cameron or George Osborne in a warehouse confronted by the working man, and you see how they try so hard to change the way they talk in order to impress the working man. You can see, you can actually hear their thought process, thinking, what do the working men like? I know, association football, they like that. I'll try and throw in a little quip here about association football. And you can just bet they've been, you know, brainstorming with their special advisors on the train on the way up. Which is the local football team? Can you think of a joke about them? Are they doing well? Are they doing badly? And then, you know, the Prime Minister will make a joke about football, and all of these men in overalls
cringe
with their arms folded will remain silent. It's terribly embarrassing.
Standing in front of a crane or something.
Yes,
always.
Exactly.
It's awful. And what sort of relationship do you have with the people you write about? As I said, you're not a reporter who's looking for a quote. You're not standing outside Downing Street trying to sort of catch a Chancellor or a Prime Minister as they run by. Is it nice to have that arm's length thing to be able to sort of to lampoon, being kind of almost like an astute TV viewer, as it were?
Well, I try to have no relationship with them at all. For one thing, I don't think it would actually help me. In fact, it might be debilitating, because, you know, if I actually got to know these people personally and found that I liked them, it would make it very hard for me to make fun of them. There was a Guardian sketch writer in the 60s and 70s called Norman Shrapnel, and he, as an absolute matter of policy, would never, ever speak to an MP in any circumstances. There was one time when another political journalist said, "For goodness sake, Norman, why do you never speak to them?" And he said, "Oh, I could never do that. It might dilute the purity of my hatred." I don't feel quite as strongly as that, but you know, I get the general point. You know, if I were friends with George Osborne, perish the thought, I think that might slightly undermine my ability to make fun of him.
That was Michael Deacon, parliamentary sketchwriter for the Daily Telegraph. After the break, we'll assess how you put political pen to paper in America and how on earth you tackle the minefield that is Lebanese politics. Stay tuned.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and this week we're asking, how do you write about politics? Now we're going to the US. When your country is the most powerful in the world, the political conversation is sure to be rich. And with increasing numbers of media outlets for people to voice their opinions on, how do you make sure you're a go-to source for the latest from the White House? Our Washington correspondent, Sasha Isenberg, is a very experienced political journalist who's reported for the likes of the New York Times, Bloomberg, and The Atlantic, and whose book, The Victory Lab, explores what it takes to win a political campaign. He talks to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield about who the boys on the bus will be next year and what it's like to be an American political journalist in 2015.
Things are coming out in a sort of fragmentary way, and there's far less sort of reflective, you know, at the end of the day or end of the week, making sense of what happened and having to distill it. And it's a lot easier also for journalists to cover campaigns from their desks in Washington or New York, wherever it may be, by following other reporters who are covering speeches or events minute by minute online, or even live streaming them at their desks. And so there's a charge to reporters who are actually out covering campaigns to bring something new in a way that there wasn't even 5-10 years ago. And the people who do it well do it exceptionally well, but I think people who are sort of doing generic commodity coverage of campaigns are being more easily revealed these days.
American politics and the way it's written about has been sort of portrayed pretty well over the years, whether that's, you know, The Boys on the Bus or David Foster Wallace's epic piece about following John McCain. Do you think the time is ripe for someone to do a similar piece now on what it's like to cover a presidential campaign?
The big thing that's changed in the sort of on the bus, on the plane part of traveling with candidates is that the reporters have gotten younger and more junior. They're diverse in all sorts of other ways compared to what they were in 1972 when it was all a bunch of men in their 30s, white men in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Now you have certainly more gender diversity and racial and ethnic diversity, but by and large, the people who are traveling with candidates right now are, you know, in their 20s, often doing on their first presidential campaign. And part of it is because there's so much of a burden if you are on the trail to be chronicling everything, often in multiple media, by video, by audio, transmitting stuff live, you know, social media. And it's far more a young person's game than an old person's game. There's, it used to be part of the culture of even that 2000 campaign that David Foster Wallace wrote about for Rolling Stone, that there was a time at the day when everything ended. You know, you reached your filing deadline in the evening and you ended up at the hotel with a staff or sometimes the candidate. And there was, you were doing work in the sense of gathering strings and ideas over drinks, but nobody had to file anything anymore. And, you know, recorders were off and cameras were away and, you know, the same thing happened when the plane took off. Your editor couldn't call you on the plane. You couldn't respond to an email. And so there were these periods over the day when you had some respite from needing to work and needing to be responsive to the outside world. That's now gone.
Let's talk about the issue of bias, because it comes up time and time again when we talk about how American politics is covered. Is there a danger when we talk about bias that actually journalists think, well, you know what, I'll make sure that no one can accuse me of being unbiased. I'll stick with the he said, she said form of journalism, which actually often ignores that something is either true or false.
You know, I think that there are certain significant forms of bias that inform political reporting. A lot of it is not that journalists are themselves partisan or sort of consciously ideological. I do think there are a lot of effectively ideological assumptions that inform the types of stories that get written or the types of questions that get asked. It's not that journalists are consciously putting their finger on a scale every time they write a story so that things weigh in favor of a Democrat over a Republican. But, you know, the fact that most journalists in the U.S. covering politics are based in New York or Washington, they grow up in, or at least develop their careers in places that are demographically more cosmopolitan or more at ease with certain types of diversity, are usually more open to global trade and immigration. It's not always clearly left-right, skeptical of certain types of labor unions. And so, you know, there are questions that get asked of Republican candidates where the analogous question doesn't get asked of Democratic candidates because there's not that same level of suspicion. And then I think you're right. There's some people who are very conscious of that, and then they overcompensate by being so even-handed that they rarely have not just the ability to referee sort of disputes of fact, but often to sort of say anything interesting.
A little earlier, we were talking to Michael Deacon, the political sketch writer here in the UK at the Daily Telegraph. And it struck me that it was strange, perhaps, that there isn't this same tradition in the US of having political sketch writers. I wonder why you think it hasn't really taken off in the US, because you certainly have the characters for it.
Yeah, I can think of one reporter, Dana Milbank at the Washington Post, who was at one point, fairly conventional, smart, elegant writer for both the Post and the Wall Street Journal, got a column, I think it's still called Washington Sketch. And the idea was that he would have a sort of comic eye and describe scenes. You know, one of the things that sort of comes across is often it's kind of rote, which is a lot of times, you know, in his columns, the joke is that events are staged and put on. And I actually find it sort of tiresome that there are only so many times you can make the observation that there are these sort of phony events that politicians engineer for the sake of media coverage or manufacturing news. I think the broader thing is that we don't have almost all of our major legacy media institutions are this sort of self-consciously, very scrupulously nonpartisan, supposedly neutral entities. And most journalists in the United States feel that if you get into the business of basically making fun of people, which for better or for worse, a good sketch column usually either evolves or devolves into, that you will, you know, run the risk of being accused of making targets out of people. I think if you go into media cultures where newspapers are not afraid to be seen playing favorites either with individual politicians or parties or sort of broad ideological, philosophical movements, then it's a lot easier to say we're going to, you know, devote some part of our pages to content that takes the piss out of people on the other side.
That was Monocle's Washington correspondent, Sasha Isenberg, speaking down the line to Steve Bloomfield. Up next, we're heading to Lebanon. Political journalists and writers in conflict-ridden countries face particular problems when crafting stories, from avoiding bias that can endanger their lives to covering subjects that involve war and violence. A good example of this is Lebanon, which even in the last decade or so has experienced turbulent times that have required skilled and nuanced reporting. Monocle's Beirut correspondent Venetia Rainey spoke to two political journalists to find out how they've dealt with the big stories and players in this tricky field.
If there's one thing you can say about Lebanese politics, it's that it's not for beginners. The constantly evolving landscape of strategic alliances, confessional concerns and patronage practicalities, the machinations of the country's various Christian, Muslim and Druze parties, each with their own cultish leader, can be bewildering.
The government of Syria, through President Assad and Foreign Minister Sharaa, has informed me today that Syria has, as a first step, redeployed all its troops in Lebanon to the Bekaa Valley.
Since Syria ended its near 30-year occupation of Lebanon in 2005, national politics has been roughly divided into two camps, March 14, who wanted Syria to withdraw, and March 8, who didn't. Covering both sides evenly is near impossible, so how do political journalists here stay impartial?
Oh, you can't, it's impossible.
That's Nicholas Blanford, a veteran Lebanon reporter and author of two books, one on the 2005 assassination of March 14 hero and former Prime Minister, Rafiq Hariri, and one on the history of the party accused of killing him, Hezbollah.
You just have to do your best as a reporter and ignore... I mean, I used to be known as a Hezbollah apologist, particularly during the 1990s when I was writing up the Israeli occupation stuff. Then I wrote a book on the Hariri assassination and I was suddenly dubbed pro-Hariri. But it's part of the course. You can't avoid it, especially in a politically polarised country like Lebanon.
For local political journalists such as May Shidiat, covering divisive issues such as the occupation of one's own country makes striking that balance even harder. Although she is now retired, in her time Shidiat was a very well-known TV news anchor and a political talk show host, famous for her outspoken criticism of Syria's influence on Lebanon and the attempt made on her life as a result. She says she largely played devil's advocate when interviewing political figures, but that in the months following Hariri's assassination in 2005, she felt it was her duty to speak her mind.
You have crucial moments in country's history where you have to stop being neutral, because otherwise being neutral means seeing what's wrong and covering it instead of trying to end a wrong situation you are witnessing in your country.
But the consequences of speaking out, as Shidiat knows all too well, can be devastating. In 2005, she too was the victim of a car bomb she says was planted by Syria and its Lebanese ally Hezbollah, just one of a spate of attacks that year on local critics of the Syrian government. Although she managed to avoid the same fate as fellow political journalists Gibran Tweni and Samir Kassir, she lost a leg and had to have her arm amputated.
In Lebanon, there is a proverb or statement that says you have in Lebanon a lot, too much freedom, but you have a lack of democracy. That means you can say whatever you want, but at the end you will pay the price if any part wants you to pay the price. So this is what happened to me. I was expressing myself, defending my country, and highlighting what was going on concerning the Rafiq Hariri assassination. I used to really take very big risks, but I never thought that these risks will cost me my life.
For non-Lebanese international correspondents, the risk of injury or death is more limited to being in the wrong place at the wrong time when fighting erupts. For writers such as Blanford, sticking your neck out is met with sharp words rather than actual violence. This is particularly true for Hezbollah, a militia created to resist Israel's occupation of Lebanon in the 80s and 90s that has since evolved into a major political and social force in the country under the leadership of Hassan Nasrallah.
في هذا اليوم نحن في حزب الله نقف هنا لنؤكد.
It was easier in the old days. So back in the 90s, Hezbollah was emerging from the civil war. It was shedding its kind of wartime image, kidnapping foreigners, you know, the suicide bomb attacks against Western targets and so on. So back then, Hezbollah was quite open to my requests for interviews. You could get to meet officials fairly easily.
These days, dealing with Hezbollah, who are especially sensitive to negative media coverage, requires a special touch.
I find that every 2 or 3 years, I have to have a meeting with whoever the head of the media department is, and we sort of clear the air, and I explain why I've been writing some of the articles I've been writing, and they voice their complaints, and then I remind them about the good old days in the 90s, and then there's all sort of slaps on the back and handshakes and promises to get on better.
As a result, Blanford has had to employ other tactics to get the inside scoop on Lebanon's most secretive party.
I have got my own contacts with Hezbollah outside the media office, and now that Hezbollah has essentially almost shut down any kind of media outreach, I rely more and more on my sort of personal contacts within the organisation than relying on interviews with officials through the formal media channels. And Hezbollah doesn't like that.
For Shidyat, giving airtime to those she suspected were behind her assassination proved difficult, especially once it became clear that she would not be reining in her anti-Syrian government opinions.
I used to receive them before 2005. They were always my guests in my program, in my political morning talk show. And I was still very tough with them. But after being the victim of a killing attempt, it was a kind of boycotting me. They wanted to prove that I was a failure because the fact of boycotting my program will show to everybody else that I'm receiving guests from one camp, not from the other camp.
From bombings to shifting allegiances, the quagmire of Lebanese politics, somewhere between a Machiavelli novel and a tragic comedy, has long been a source of fascination for writers and journalists. Thankfully for the next generation of budding political reporters, however, these days it is much less dangerous than it was before. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thanks, Venetia. So how do you write about politics with flair and care, it seems? You need to catch people's attention and have a bit of wit, warmth and charm, but you can't be caught writing fiction. If you're commenting on the state of the way we run our affairs, you'd better have validated your sources and know what you're talking about. Opinion's easy. Knowing things first is the only way. In the UK, the tradition of satire seeps into much political commentary, while in the US, there's a pall of significance and seriousness over dispatches from the White House, Congress and the Senate. While in Lebanon, a quip at someone's expense could cost that wise guy journalist their livelihood or their life. So how do you write about politics? With care and an ear for a quote, of course. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly, the thick of it, Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.